This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Quick quiz. Can you name all five oceans?
Atlantic.
Pacific.
Indian Ocean.
Arctic.
The answer is... the Southern Ocean. No schools teach this. The Southern Ocean was only recognized 6 years ago. It stores most of the heat and almost half the carbon we add to the atmosphere. We would be cooked without it. Now the southern storm track is changing. Fresh water invades with ice and atmospheric rivers. Major flows of heat and water around Antarctica could reverse soon. Scientists find a control knob for climate feedbacks in the Southern Ocean. That may be where climate this century is determined. In this program, we explore climate and the Southern Ocean. We have two experts with years of research and publications, Dr. Zach Kaufman at Scripps Institute in San Diego and Professor Richard Williams, University of Liverpool. I'm Alex Smith. Let's go down to that unknown frontier of climate change. When it comes to soaking up excess heat we add to the atmosphere, the Southern Ocean is doing the heavy lifting. Over decades, Professor Richard Williams investigates the role of oceans in climate change. With his PhD in physical oceanography, Williams is professor of Earth, Ocean, and Ecological Sciences at the University of Liverpool. From Liverpool, Rick Williams, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Welcome. Pleased to be with you.
Human greenhouse gases are keeping more solar energy inside Earth's systems, land, air, and oceans. How much of that heat and carbon dioxide is captured by the Southern Ocean?
Yes, well, the Southern Ocean is playing a disproportionately important role in the climate system. If we look over the historical period, when we integrate climate models over the historical period, we find that over 80% of the extra heat supplied to the climate system is being taken up by the Southern Ocean, and maybe about 40% of the extra carbon is being taken up by the Southern Ocean. Now, this is important because this ocean uptake of heat and carbon is reducing the forcing that would otherwise occur for the planet. So it's reducing the amount of atmospheric carbon, and it's reducing the rise in surface temperature.
As I learn more about this, the location of the Southern Ocean seems a bit fuzzy. Many public sources call the sea anything south of 60 degrees latitude. Another recent study on oceanography used 54 degrees south as the boundary. Your paper defines the Southern Ocean as something much smaller, south of 30 degrees south. Why is that?
In some sense, I think it's slightly arbitrary definitions. The heart of the Southern Ocean is the part of the ocean that is south of the southern tip of South America and South Africa. Those waters circulate around Antarctica, and those waters connect very strongly with the atmosphere. But in terms of trying to understand the role of a particular region on the wider climate system, it's sometimes useful to apply larger domain definitions to get robust inferences.
And whether you define the Southern Ocean narrowly or broadly, this is a relatively small share of the total world sea. The Pacific alone is 8 times bigger. How can this small patch of sea account for so much carbon and heat intake?
Well, there are different perspectives here. From an ocean perspective, what's unique about the Southern Ocean is because of the pattern of wind forcing, the winds bring deep waters up to the surface south of the Antarctic Circumpolar Current. That bringing up of the surface waters effectively connects the deep ocean to the surface atmosphere. Those waters are cold and they're relatively old, and so then they are susceptible to taking up some of the excess heat and the excess carbon that is in the atmosphere. Those waters then are transferred from the surface into the ocean interior and then are hidden away from the atmosphere for many decades or centuries. So there is a unique connection between the global ocean and the atmosphere over the southern hemisphere.
But you say that doesn't mean more carbon and heat are being stored in the southern ocean. It doesn't stay there. Why not?
No, the southern ocean connects with the other northern basins. In the Atlantic, waters that move from the surface are transported as part of an overturning circulation which spreads into the North Atlantic. Southern ocean also forms bottom waters that spread northwards. So waters both at intermediate depths, at depths of maybe 500 meters, and along the seafloor, they both spread from the southern ocean into the northern basins. So these properties that the southern ocean take up from the atmosphere, both excess heat and carbon, actually end up often residing in the northern basins if we wait long enough. But the southern ocean waters originally uptake the heat and carbon in the southern hemisphere, but that heat and carbon is often stored in the northern basins.
Do we know how much hotter the world would be without this carbon and heat capture system in the southern ocean? Has anybody tried to calculate that?
I'm not aware of anyone calculating that, but in many ways the climate system is quite complicated. You know, over 90% of the extra heat stored in the climate system is held in the global ocean. And as I said, typically 80% of that heat is being sequestered in the southern ocean. But it would certainly, if this was not happening, then it would lead to much greater surface temperatures. But I'm not aware of someone having made that calculation.
Obviously, carbon dioxide and heat are quite different. The carbon mainly becomes an acid in the sea. Is the Southern Ocean becoming more acidic, and say more acidic than the North Atlantic, for example?
Yes, heat and carbon do behave in different ways. The key thing with carbon dioxide is it reacts in seawater, forming carbonate and bicarbonate ions. And that's actually why the ocean stores up so much carbon. Only about 1% of the carbon held in the ocean is in the form of dissolved carbon dioxide. Most of it is in the form of bicarbonate ions. One of the prices we pay for that enhanced store is that can make the waters more acidic. But the acidity, it's not, it does vary slightly regionally, but it's not a signal that's preferentially enhanced in the Southern Ocean, as far as I'm aware. The ocean circulation redistributes those signals over the globe. So it's not only an enhancement in acidification in the locations where the carbon is originally being taken up. The ocean circulation and transport redistributes those signals.
Why is the Southern Ocean dominant in heat uptake but not carbon capture?
This is a very interesting issue, and our last paper focused on this question. The Southern Ocean is unique in terms of its connection with the atmosphere, but there's another part of the story. And the other part of the story is the forcing in the atmosphere. Over the industrial period, we've had more dust or aerosols, we call it, being emitted in the northern hemisphere. This dust and aerosols provide a cooling effect on the climate system. So the planet as a whole, up until maybe the 1980s, has been forced by increase in greenhouse gases acting to warm the climate system, together with an emission of these aerosols and this dust, which provides a cooling effect. And so there's been a partial compensation between the two. Now, that's been happening in a global sense, this partial compensation, but it's also been happening in a regional sense, in that because these aerosols have been historically emitted more in the northern hemisphere, then in that region, the warming effect from increasing greenhouse gases has been locally offset by the aerosols. Now, in contrast, over the Southern Ocean, there has not been the same input from aerosols, so the effect of the greenhouse gassing has not been offset there. So that has then led to this asymmetry between how the Southern Ocean acts in taking up heat compared with carbon. The pattern of aerosol forcing has reduced the northern hemisphere uptake of heat, but it has not affected the northern hemisphere uptake of carbon. So the carbon uptake has been more symmetric between hemispheres, but there's been this big hemispheric contrast in heat uptake historically.
There's a growing public and scientific worry that the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, could slow down or even stop. Europe would be much colder. That AMOC connects to overturning in the Southern Ocean as well, deep under the sea. They are part of one system, really. What does your research tell us about the health of the so-called global conveyor belt moderating climate?
Well, that's a very good question, and there isn't a clear consensus on this question. Direct observations, such as measurements of the strength of the Florida Current, forming part of the Gulf Stream, show that there hasn't been any change in the strength of that current over the last 40 years. But climate models, their projections, all are saying there should be a weakening in the Atlantic overturning circulation. It might simply be a question that our observational record is not yet long enough to show that decrease. Climate models are certainly sending a warning that there should be a weakening in this Atlantic overturning. I do not believe that will cease, because part of that overturning is linked to the action of the winds as well, and the wind forcing is unlikely to dramatically change. But there could well be a weakening. So that will affect the communication of those Southern Ocean waters and their transport up to the Northern Hemisphere. That is a widespread concern about what the future might hold.
Yes, our guest Matthew England down in Australia warned that the Antarctic overturning circulation is slowing down and could possibly stop. So these things are all connected. I guess we'll have to wait and see on that one. Now, parts of the Southern Ocean, especially south of 30 degrees, goes very dark for several months in the austral winter. It also gets extremely cold. Does this seasonality affect capture of carbon dioxide or heat down there?
The whole exchange of heat and carbon is a very seasonal process. Obviously, changes in temperature vary seasonally. During summer, there can be a heat import, and then in the winter, there's a strong heat loss. But the same is happening for the biology. An important drawdown of carbon into the ocean is the effects of biological cycling, where the growth of phytoplankton leads to a drawdown of carbon. That process is happening in the springtime when there's a supply of nutrients and trace metals and there's enough light. But that process isn't happening during the winter time. So there are very strong seasonal contrasts in how the ocean takes up both heat and carbon. And that is part of the challenge in trying to work out from data what is happening. The overall annual uptake is a small residual of the seasonal contributions.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Rick Williams from the University of Liverpool. We're talking about the ways oceans save us from immediate warming and their role in the future. Rick, what do you mean by hemispheric differences in radiative forcing?
You know, the planet ultimately is receiving extra radiative forcing because of the amounts of greenhouse gases. One of the most important greenhouse gases is water vapor, but carbon emissions have been increasing atmospheric CO2 levels, and that is leading to increased amounts of radiative forcing. We can see that in increasing temperatures in the surface and the lower part of the atmosphere. In fact, we can also see signals of that in the upper atmosphere, where there's in fact a cooling in the upper atmosphere, and this all links to the heating profile from carbon dioxide.
I'm looking at various ways hemispheric imbalance can be a climate driver or feedback. You talk about lack of symmetry between the hemispheres for heat. Does this heat imbalance have impacts? Does it change things?
This hemispheric imbalance is a key way as to how the global ocean circulation operates. Southern ocean waters spread northwards at intermediate depths of maybe 500 meters. Those waters spread northwards for all latitudes in the Atlantic. That northward spreading of waters also takes nutrients northwards from the Southern Ocean, and those that enables plants to phytoplankton to bloom in the Northern Hemisphere. It also, those waters are ultimately cooled in the North Atlantic. So, and then in turn, those North Atlantic waters cool and sink and return at depth and move southwards. So there's a whole set of overturning pathways, and the Southern Ocean is a key place by which those surface waters interact with the atmosphere, spread north, and then deep waters return to the Southern Ocean and communicate again with the atmosphere.
For this study, you selected the IPCC SSP 2 to 4.5 scenario, calling it middle of the road. Personally, I think it's optimistically low now, but if you had chosen the worst outcome, say the old RCP 8.5, would that change the future of carbon and heat in the Southern Ocean?
Yes, as we move to, so far we've been talking about the historical period. And in that historical period, the Southern Ocean is taking up over 80% of the global heat, but only about 40% of the global carbon. And that's linked to an asymmetry in the aerosol forcing over the hemispheres. Now, for future projections, we expect the greenhouse gas forcing to dominate the radiated forcing and the effect of aerosols to be less important. So when we use climate models to make those projections, it then becomes much more symmetric in terms of how the hemispheres take up heat. So the Southern Ocean, from using climate models, we find takes up typically just over 50% of the extra heat that the global ocean sequesters.
Our recent guest, Brian Soden, published science showing the reduction in aerosols in the Northern Hemisphere in the last few years has been offset by more clouds emerging in the Southern Hemisphere. Did your study account for changes in clouds?
We were using coupled climate models, which, yes, have cloud feedbacks. So in principle, some of those effects are incorporated. But this is one of the big unknowns in climate models. There's a big spread in, there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of how to represent cloud feedbacks and the effect of aerosols on clouds. And that uncertainty is particularly large over the Southern Hemisphere and the Southern Ocean. There are issues about whether you get super cold droplets or ice crystals, and they have different radiative effects. So there's a very large uncertainty in terms of the cloud feedbacks. Different models have different representations of those feedbacks, and that's a big uncertainty.
Your work suggests the direction of flow of excess heat in the Southern Ocean could change direction in the future. Do we know what that means and when that might happen?
Historically, the Southern Ocean has been very important in sequestering much of the heat, and that's redistributed by the overturning circulations. But in these future projections, we're seeing the Southern Ocean and the Northern Hemispheres provide a more comparable contribution. These speculations are probably at the limit of these climate models, but they then, yes, suggest that our inferences in terms of how the past ocean has operated need not always carry over for the future. And that, yes, there are implications as we move to a future state where there's much stronger greenhouse gas forcing and there's more symmetrical heat uptake, that the heat transports will then also alter.
But you're suggesting the Southern Ocean overturning may become less important in a warming world?
Well, I think it's more that the Northern Hemispheres start to catch up in terms of importance. If we have extreme levels of greenhouse gases, then historically the northern oceans, that effect has been offset by the aerosol forcing, so that the Southern Ocean was then becoming the remaining place to take up that excess heat. In future states with even greater greenhouse gas forcing, yes, the Southern Ocean is still important in taking up that heat, but the Northern Oceans start to play a more significant role. So I'm not saying that the Southern Ocean heat uptake is ceasing. It's more that the Northern Oceans also start to contribute to the global ocean heat uptake.
Paradoxically, the Southern Ocean has been cooling over the past 30 years of measurements, despite a warming world. And then, in the last couple of years, it started warming. Do you have thoughts about that?
So I think you're discussing what's happening closer to Antarctica, where there's all sorts of ice interactions. So I'm not sure about the details there, but the more general point is that the Southern Ocean is a key place to take up heat. But much of that heat is then transported elsewhere. Then the actual surface temperatures can be very strongly affected by the strength of the winds. So if the winds are slightly stronger, that can lead to the surface cooling. But that's the paradoxical or interesting issue about the Southern Ocean. The Southern Ocean is taking up this heat, but it's not staying in that location. It's transported elsewhere. So there might be a slight cooling or a slight warming in the Southern Ocean, but its main role is taking up this excess heat from the atmosphere and redistributing it at depth over the global ocean.
Rick, as we wrap up, what are you working on now?
I'm actually working on a project about the Gulf Stream. So everyone is aware of how the Gulf Stream is important for redistributing heat. European climate is often claimed to be much warmer, or Western European climate is claimed to be much warmer through the input and through the effect of the Gulf Stream transporting warm waters towards Europe. We've been addressing the role of the Gulf Stream on the carbon cycle, and we are arguing that the Gulf Stream provides a similar role in terms of the supply of nutrients and carbon. So for nutrients, the Gulf Stream at depth transports nutrients northwards, and when those waters at depth from the Gulf Stream eventually reach the surface at maybe 50 degrees north, that supply of nutrients allows the phytoplankton to flourish, and that provides a carbon drawdown. Now, in the same way, the waters carried along the Gulf Stream at depth are often old, actually originating from the Southern Ocean. And when those old waters again reach the surface at higher latitudes, such as 50 degrees north, because those waters are old, they take up slightly more carbon because the atmospheric carbon levels are much higher than when those waters were originally in contact with the atmosphere. Our view is that not only is the Gulf Stream important in affecting the transfer of heat in the climate system, it affects the transfer of nutrients and old waters, which then affect the carbon sink of the North Atlantic.
From the University of Liverpool, we've been speaking with Professor Richard Williams. He led papers into the role of the Southern Ocean in the global climate response to carbon emissions, and more recently, asymmetries in the Southern Ocean contribution to global heat and carbon uptake. You can find links to the science and my notes published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Rick, thank you for helping us understand the big picture here.
Thank you. Delighted to talk with you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Please, please support your local radio station with a good donation. You know print media is floundering. TV has totally sold out to the big corporate machine and they're losing viewers. Nonprofit radio is one of the last stands of advertising free speech. I count on you to put your money where your ears are by supporting your nonprofit radio station.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Against all expectations and model predictions, and despite record global warming, the ocean at the south end of the world is cooling. Is the Southern Ocean acting like a brake on global warming? Do changes there rearrange climate where you live, even on the other side of the world? Our guest, Zachary Kaufman, is a postdoctoral scholar affiliated with the Scripps Institute of Oceanography in San Diego. He specializes in polar ocean dynamics and publishes papers about both poles. In March 2025, Kaufman led a paper investigating cooling in the Southern Ocean, just what we want to know, and where climate kind of goes wrong in the models. From California, Zach Kaufman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Good to hear from you.
So, a 2023 paper led by Sarah Kang said, quote, "Recent global climate feedback is controlled by Southern Ocean cooling." That's a huge statement. The Southern Ocean regulates climate feedback. Do you agree?
Yeah, so this is something that I think we've come to a greater appreciation for in recent years. The Southern Ocean has an outsized influence on the climate system. That's something that we've known for a very long time. Locally, through its uptake of heat and carbon, sort of serving as a buffer against climate change. But its impacts aren't just local. They're further afield as well. And so what that global climate feedback is referring to is the adjustments in the climate system that happen under an increase in greenhouse gases. And these adjustments could either amplify the warming that you get or damp the warming. And what we've come to understand is when you have this multi-decadal period of cooling in the Southern Ocean that you referred to, what it tends to do is have influence on sea surface temperatures in the tropics, particularly in the tropical Pacific. And what this does, it has an impact, for instance, on the reflectivity of clouds, on ocean heat uptake, and tends to lead to a more, what we call a La Nina-like sea surface temperature pattern, where you have colder than normal sea surface temperatures in the eastern Pacific. So when this happens, it leads to what we call a reduction in climate sensitivity. So the amount of warming that you would expect for a given amount of greenhouse gas emissions is lower when you have these negative feedbacks at play. So yes, in short, I do agree with that statement. So this is definitely still an active area of research in terms of the mechanisms underpinning this.
Well, before we go further, we have to get in a couple of basics. What is the mixed layer, and how is that different from things like sea surface temperatures?
So in the ocean, the mixed layer is the layer of the ocean that is homogenized and well-mixed and directly responds to forcings from the atmosphere, so things like wind, like evaporation. You know, you can't see this with your own eyes, but a good way to visualize the ocean is sort of as this kind of layer cake of different water masses of different densities, so lighter density on top, higher density below. And this mixed layer is this uppermost layer, where you have the same temperature and salinity throughout this mixed layer. And then at the bottom, we have this sharp density gradient that kind of isolates the mixed layer from the ocean below it. So it's a sort of a distinct water mass in that sense.
Well, most of us think the ocean gets colder as you go deeper, but your study, at least talking about the Southern Ocean, gets to deeper waters that are warmer than the surface. How does that work?
Yeah, so this is a rather counterintuitive aspect of the ocean at higher latitudes near the pole, and particularly in the Southern Ocean. So your intuition is correct that we would often expect warm water to be on top of cold water because warm water, all else being equal, is less dense. It turns out at high latitudes, however, that the dominant control on your ocean density is not temperature, but rather salinity. And so because of that, in the Southern Ocean, what you tend to have is these warm, salty water masses below the mixed layer. And because of that, because the ocean at depth is saltier, you can have cold water on top of warm water, provided that that cold water in the mixed layer is sufficiently fresh or less salty than the water below it. So that it's really salinity that's determining that vertical structure.
Well, large as it is, Antarctica is a small part of the Southern Ocean. Is ocean cooling just around that continent, and is cooler water transported further north?
So first I should say, in terms of this multi-decadal cooling in the Southern Ocean, it's worth mentioning that this trend has abruptly reversed in recent years for reasons that we are still trying to understand. But in general, you know, if you think on multi-decadal timescales, we've long expected that warming will be delayed in the Southern Ocean relative to other parts of the world. this cold water can be moved further north towards the equator, and this contributes to some of those teleconnections with the tropics that I referred to earlier, and that paper led by Sarah Tang studies as well.
Your group found at least five explanations or drivers that might cause the Southern Ocean to cool despite global warming. You chose to focus on one. Please tell us about that.
The mechanism that we focused on is an increasing input of fresh water into the Southern Ocean that is making that mixed layer near the surface more fresh. So as I was saying before, one reason we think that this could be contributing to this multi-decadal cooling that we saw is that when you add this fresh water, it stratifies the mixed layer, and so it makes it harder to mix the warmer water below up towards the surface. So in other words, that warm water is trapped at depth as opposed to being able to make it to the surface. And for a variety of reasons, we believe that climate models, the things that we are using to make future projections of climate change, aren't capturing the freshening trend adequately. And that's led to some biases in these climate models that we want to correct. And so we set out to see if we corrected this underestimated freshening trend in the Southern Ocean, what would that do? And what we found is that it is able to explain a substantial gap between the sea surface temperatures that we see in models and observations, and this freshening trend is already having an important influence on the Southern Ocean and perhaps much, much further afield as well.
Is this fresh water just coming from Antarctic ice?
No. So we focused on two sources of fresh water. One, as you said, is from the Antarctic ice sheet, which has been losing mass in recent decades. So about between 100 to 300 gigatons of anomalous meltwater from the Antarctic ice sheet. When you melt landfast ice, that ice is a source of fresh water. So in other words, it freshens the ocean when it melts. The other thing that we looked at were changes in precipitation, so changes in rain and snow falling on the Southern Ocean, and that's been another source of freshening as well, largely because of a shift in the storm track further south into the Southern Ocean, and also this general feature that we expect with global warming called wet gets wetter, dry gets drier. So in other words, in a warming climate, what we expect are our wet regions, like the Southern Ocean, to receive even more precipitation than they were in the past, and then dry regions get drier. And so what we found is that on climate models, they aren't accounting for this fresh water from the Antarctic ice sheet that changes the ocean circulation. And then we also, these climate models are underestimating the increase in precipitation that's been falling as well.
Does most of the increasing rainfall or snowfall in far southern latitudes fall into the ocean or onto the Antarctic itself? And does that balance matter?
It does. So most of it is falling on the ocean itself. So this may be surprising given that Antarctica is covered in frozen water, but Antarctica is actually a quite a dry continent. Not much rain and snow falls on Antarctica relative to further north. You know, basically the reason that ice sticks around is the snow that does fall does not melt. It accumulates. But that balance is important. And if you have the amount of precipitation that falls on Antarctica year to year, can of course then have downstream impacts on what melts later. But in short, the majority of the precipitation that we were focused on in our study is what falls directly onto the Southern Ocean, and particularly where the strong storm track that encircles this ocean is located.
And we have seen news about atmospheric rivers roaring across the Southern Oceans all the way to Antarctica, dropping big loads of rain or snow and bringing warmer air. Talk to us about the role of atmospheric rivers in southern seas.
So atmospheric rivers, they are these structures in the atmosphere that can bring large amounts of precipitation in short periods. They tend to often tap moisture sources and air masses from the tropics as well, so they can often be quite warm. And so when you get an atmospheric river event, it can lead to much warmer than average conditions. It can lead to a reduction in sea ice, you know, either from just the mechanical forcing associated with the wind in the storm or for just the rain falling on snow, for instance. So particularly in recent years, when we've seen this really anomalously low sea ice in the Southern Ocean, there's been a lot of looking into what the role of the atmospheric rivers could be playing in this.
Scientists point to ways changes in the Southern Ocean impact systems in other oceans. Does it go the other way? For example, would a strong El Nino affect the Southern Ocean too?
Yeah, so this is, you know, one of the large, what you're touching on is just a large challenge in climate science in general, which is determining the direction of causality between various processes, because often indeed that causality can go in both directions. So, you know, at the beginning of our conversation, you referenced the possibility that the Southern Ocean could be influencing things like El Nino in the tropics, but indeed it can go the other way as well. So the Southern Ocean storm track also responds to El Nino. I think this is definitely at the frontier of our understanding right now, but there's been a lot of work looking at the possibility of a two-way teleconnection between the Southern Ocean and the tropics. And indeed, how strong that link is going to depend on things like the properties of clouds and so forth. And so it's really important that we resolve these processes correctly in climate models to capture this connection between the Southern Ocean and the tropics. And we tend to see, again, that colder conditions in the Southern Ocean tend to be associated with a more La Nina-like sea surface temperature pattern in the tropics, where your eastern tropical Pacific is colder than average. So then that begs the question, what's the chicken and what's the egg, right? What initiated that change? Was it a change in the tropics that first initiated this? Was it a change in the Southern Ocean that first initiated this? And then, of course, what are the relative roles of climate change versus just internal variability and random noise in the climate system? And these are all open questions.
What a great problem. It's a moving target in a somewhat chaotic system that has patterns. It's really difficult to do what we're trying to do, to see into the future, and yet we have to do it.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Zach Kaufman. We're talking about the unknown sea, the Southern Ocean. Have to be honest, many of us glaze over when scientists start talking about salinity and seawater. But your paper and countless others, salinity is identified as a key to ocean function and global heat transport. Could you introduce us to the salinity factors in your 2025 study?
The role that salinity plays in the Southern Ocean is that it determines the sort of the degree to which water near the surface is connected with water below it. And so what salinity does is it determines the stratification of your water. So the way that I like to think about this is, you know, you put salad dressing in the refrigerator, and overnight the waters of the liquids of different densities in that salad dressing separate out, and you get these layers with, you know, the olive oil in one layer and the balsamic vinegar in another layer. And what salinity does is it determines that strength of stratification that you get in the ocean. The reason we focused on salinity in our paper is that has really important implications for just the broad scale circulation of the Southern Ocean. You know, what are the temperature trends going to be, and then, you know, how much heat is going to be stored at depth? Is it staying at depth, or is it going to make it to the surface?
When it comes to fresh water from Antarctic ice, we picture water dribbling off the cliffs or chunks falling into the sea. Your paper adds ice shelf mass loss. What is that, and how does that contribute to cooling in the sea?
Yeah, the really interesting thing about Antarctica is that a lot of the meltwater that is entering the ocean comes through what is called basal melting. And so the word basal is referring to the base of ice shelves. So these ice shelves are out floating on the ocean. They're connected to the continent, but these basically these big tongues of ice that come out from the continent and then are floating on top of the ocean, and they're exposed to warm water at their base. So there are these cavities under the ice shelves that you know we can't see from a top-down perspective, but if you were to, you know, take a submersible under the ice shelf, you would be able to see this. And this happens to be where a lot of that melt water comes from. You know, that sometimes we don't think about these ice shelves because the melt water from these ice shelves aren't going to directly contribute to sea level rise because they're coming from ice that's already floating on the ocean to begin with. But that melt water can have really important implications for the global ocean circulation because, of course, the amount of melt water coming from these ice shelves is going to influence the salinity of the ocean.
So is the sea in the Southern Ocean actually cooling, or is it cooling relative to other oceans which are warming up?
The answer to this question will have changed, you know, in recent years. So from probably we've had reliable satellite observations of sea ice and sea surface temperature for about the past 40 to 50 years. And what we saw from around 1979 to 2014, 2015 was this very, very, you know, very weak, not particularly significant cooling trend. But it was notable nonetheless because it's occurring against the backdrop of global warming, which points to, you know, a unique situation in the Southern Ocean. And then since 2015, this very weak cooling trend has abruptly reversed. And to give an idea of how abrupt this change is, the Antarctic winter sea ice loss that occurred over the past decade is of similar magnitude to the total Arctic sea ice loss that occurred over the past 40 years. So this change happened really quickly. And so that cooling trend seems to have reversed. Whether that's a permanent reversal to a new state is the signal of global warming now finally emerging in the Southern Ocean. A delayed emergence of the warming signal, or is this, you know, a temporary shift and that we could expect more cooling into the future is still an open question. What our study suggests is that this Antarctic meltwater, which we expect to increase in the coming decades, is really helping to delay warming in the region. It's already having an impact. But clearly, it's been outweighed by other factors in recent years.
But the best climate-coupled models in the world did not predict that cooling trend while it was existing. What is the problem with the models?
So what our study focused on was this underestimated freshwater input. And, you know, part of, with climate models, one challenge that you face is that the more comprehensive model that you have, you tend to lose some details in the process of making it global and very comprehensive. And one thing that it just doesn't account for is this increasing flux of Antarctic meltwater into the Southern Ocean. That's just a forcing on the Southern Ocean that's completely missing from these models. And so, you know, what one way that you can check this is we do things called historical simulations, where we subject our climate model to the conditions of the historical period that we have observations for, and then we look and see, okay, how well does this model simulator reproduce our observations? And what we've seen is that pretty consistently these models would have expected the Southern Ocean to be warming decades ago, whereas in observations we've only seen it since 2015. And so what our study points to is that it's these missing freshwater sources that have led to that discrepancy between models and observations. And of course, these things are just important to resolve and explain, because to have confidence in our future projections of climate change, we need to know that they can at least somewhat reproduce the observed state of the climate that we see in observations.
It is dangerous to travel in the Southern Ocean. The storms and the winds are legendary. A new paper, December 3rd, 2025, suggests ocean warming in the southern summer is regulated by these storms. Does world climate partly depend on winds and storms in the Southern Ocean? And is there any suggestion those might change in a warming world?
You know, I've been focused on freshwater in our conversation thus far, but winds are another very important factor. I would say probably among the top three in determining temperature and salinity in the Southern Ocean. As you mentioned, the Southern Ocean, just from its geography, it encircles the globe, and there are no continents to break up the storm track between, you know, the latitudes of around, say, you know, 55 to 65 degrees south. And so you have these really strong winds blowing from west to east. We call this the Southern Ocean storm track. And what we've seen is that this storm track has both been strengthening and shifting poleward in recent years, and we expect that to continue into the future. There are two drivers of this. One is you know, climate change, global warming, but also interestingly the ozone hole as well is thought to contribute to this trend as well. What that does is you have a larger winds on the surface, and what that can do is increase mixing to help bring warm water from depth to the surface. So the opposite of what fresh water does. And so perhaps some of this trend reversal that we've seen in recent years may be this tug of war between changes in wind and changes in freshwater input. And if this wind-driven mixing is winning out and deepening our mixed layer, sort of then we would expect indeed for the temperature trend to reverse as well.
Have you heard anything about a tipping point in any of these processes we're talking about?
Tipping points are typically defined as the substantial, widespread, and irreversible changes in the climate system. So there's a number of tipping points that we worry about in this part of the world. One is that these ice shelves, which I mentioned earlier, if they melt and thin very quickly, they basically buttress and hold back the flow of ice from the rest of the continent above it. And so if those ice shelves disintegrate, you can very rapidly increase the flow and melt of ice from the Antarctic continent and lead to a very sort of abrupt increase in sea level rise. That's one tipping point that people are worried about. Another, which I think is perhaps more closely related to my study that we've been talking about, is the overturning ocean circulation. And so the ocean circulation globally, we can think of it as a conveyor belt with waters sinking at high latitudes and then moving towards the equator and upwelling. And this is really important for storage of heat and carbon dioxide in our oceans. If we are increasing the stratification of our ocean with fresh water, we can slow down this overturning circulation. People think about this a lot in the Northern Hemisphere. In fact, it's the premise for the movie The Day After Tomorrow. So people may be familiar about this process, which happens in the Northern Hemisphere as well. But what we do believe that this overturning circulation near Antarctica has been slowing down in recent decades.
You know, as we wrap up here, I don't want to leave this as a problem just for scientists and modelers. I think fundamental changes in the Southern Ocean could alter the future of the world. What do you say?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think it's an underappreciated region for two reasons. One is, of course, the human population in that part of the world is quite low. Antarctica is not inhabited by any permanent settlements other than scientific research stations. So oftentimes it can seem out of sight, out of mind. And then also it's a very hard place to explore. It's a very hostile condition. And so, you know, we are only just starting to really get comprehensive observations for this part of the world. It's still a very data sparse region. But it's really important that we improve those observations because, as we've been talking about, changes that happen in the Southern Ocean don't stay in the Southern Ocean. It's really an area that has an outsized impact on the global climate system. And it's the future trajectory of temperature trends there, whether do we expect a return to this kind of weak cooling trend or delayed warming, or have we entered a new regime of rapid warming in the Southern Ocean? How that that changes into the future is really going to determine the rate of global warming and impact, you know, everything from sea level rise to global weather systems. So anyone who's interested in the climate and interested in trying to understand what the future holds, I think should be paying a lot of attention to this region.
We have been speaking with Dr. Zachary Kaufman from Scripps Institute in San Diego. He is lead author of the paper, The Impact of Underestimated Southern Ocean Freshening on Simulated Historical Sea Surface Temperature Trends. Find links to the science in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Zach, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Coming up next week, our annual holiday music special. Listen for a whole hour of Radio EcoShock climate music for those in the fire and flood zones, for ordinary people caught up in the climate whirlwind. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
You have 60 seconds.
Hey, I know that one, man.
Starts with a B.
Father, what is it, man?
I knew it when I came in here, man.
Ends with a B.
Oh, don't tell me. Happy birthday.
10 seconds, Bob.
Down at the bottom of the world, where no one goes. Hidden giants, hidden chains.